Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. Are you ready to lose weight? With Effecty, getting access to powerful GLP-1 weight loss medications has never been easier or more affordable. Effecty offers compounded semaglutide, the same active ingredient as the popular name brands, but for up to 80% less. These medications work by regulating appetite and blood sugar, helping you lose weight in a sustainable, science-backed way. Getting started is so simple. Just fill out a short medical questionnaire, then connect with a licensed provider through a quick chat-based telehealth consultation. If you're eligible, your prescription gets shipped straight to your door. No hassle, no waiting rooms. With transparent pricing, no hidden fees, and no membership required, Effecty is committed to making proven weight loss treatments accessible to everyone. Effecty gave me the opportunity to try their service out, and I have to say, it is just as easy as they say it is. I filled out the questionnaire, and within days, a package arrived at my door filled with everything I needed and detailed instructions. Their website also tells you everything you need to know, and you can always chat with your healthcare provider. It really is that simple and convenient. So if you're ready to level up your weight loss game, my listeners can now get $50 off of GLP-1 weight loss treatments at effecty.com with code ATTWG at checkout. That's effecty.com, EFFECTY.com, and use the code ATTWG to get $50 off your first month of GLP-1 weight loss treatment. No hassles, no memberships, and no hidden fees. So get started today. On the afternoon of March 30th, 1977, a young mother is brutally stabbed to death while home with her three young children. Her two oldest children, Brandy Summers and Tiffany Wise, were taken. Her youngest child, Stacy Wise, who was only 8 months old at the time, was later found sitting alone in the hallway, completely unharmed. Over the course of the next 3 years, police would uncover what seemingly amounted to a criminal conspiracy spanning across several states. But despite many witness accounts and even a highly publicized and lengthy trial, Tiffany and Brandy remain missing over 40 years later. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Brandy Summers and Tiffany Wise. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for joining us once again. I just stumbled across this case recently during one of my frequent bouts of insomnia, and it's so compelling that I cannot believe I've never heard of it before. This episode is going to be a basic overview, but it would be a perfect subject for a long-form investigative podcast or a documentary, which is not what we do.
No, we do not have the time for that.
We do not, but free idea for anyone out there who does, because several of the key players in this story are still alive, and it would be absolutely amazing because there are so many unanswered questions.
Even from the start, like, this sounds terrifying.
It is. It's insane. Like, the whole story is crazy. And that is why it's going to be a two-parter, because as I mentioned, there's this lengthy, crazy trial and a criminal conspiracy. And yeah, that's not enough. Like, even though we're only doing basically an overview of this, it was still too much to fit into one episode. But before we dive into all of this, I want to thank those of you who have joined us over on our Patreon page. So thank you, Jessica R. We really appreciate you. And if you would like to join us, you can do so at patreon.com/ATTWGpod, and you will actually get access to part two of this early. But now let's get into Tiffany and Brandy's story. Brandy Jondell Summers was born on January 2nd, 1972, to Beverly Wise and Roy Summers. Beverly and Roy were only married for a short amount of time, like around 6 months. They married on April 10th, 1971, and they were divorced by October of that same year. So they actually split up while Beverly was still pregnant with Brandy.
You said December to October?
April to October.
So they had me beat.
Yes, your shortest marriage was slightly longer.
10 months.
Yeah, no, Roy has been married more times than you, too. So we'll get into all that. Beverly later met Claude Wise, who was in the Air Force. The pair married on June 17th, 1973, and Beverly's daughter, Stacy, said that her father raised Brandy as his own. Beverly then gave birth to the couple's first child together, Tiffany Claudette Wise, on March 24th, 1975. Reasons for Beverly and Roy's divorce differ based on who you ask. Roy's sister, Karen said that Beverly was flirtatious, while Beverly's mother said that her daughter only told her that Roy was cruel. And apparently I was reading, because there are so many newspaper articles about this, and one I found that Roy had said that he had found Beverly with, like, another guy, and there was a physical altercation, and police were called, and it was a whole thing.
But did you ever find anything other than that one article to back that up?
Absolutely not. But either way, Beverly seemed to find happiness with Claude, and she gave birth to their second daughter, Stacy, less than a year and a half after Tiffany. So by 1977, the pair had three children. So they had Brandy, Tiffany, and Stacy. The family lived in the Del Rosa section of San Bernardino, California. Roy Summers, I couldn't find out really if he had any contact with his daughter, again, because the stories differ. Like, people on Roy's side, like his family and friends, say that, like, he didn't care about the divorce. He didn't care about losing Brandy, like, you know, again, because Brandy wasn't born yet. So he was just like, you know, whatever about the whole thing. But then other people say that Roy hated Beverly, like, held a major grudge against her. But what I couldn't find out was if he had any contact with Brandy or visitation or anything. So I really don't have a clear picture based on the news articles of how involved Roy was or wasn't in Brandy's life. Roy was a farrier, meaning he made horseshoes. So he was basically, you know, itinerant and just kind of went around to different horse farms and shoed horses. He also had family all over and was constantly with a new girlfriend or wife. I'm not sure which number she was, but Beverly was one of seven wives, at least, that Roy eventually had.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And honestly, like, all the papers stopped counting wives in, like, the 80s. So, I mean, well, it could have been way more.
Because why not?
Yeah. Like, it's just like he had seven by, like, the early 80s. So who knows what happened after that. And, you know, he was apparently pretty lax with paperwork, too, because he was actually charged with bigamy at one point.
I feel like there was that was just, like, the 70s and 80s. There was a lot of lax of.
Well, there's no, like, internet. There's no centralized bookkeeping.
Anything. Yeah.
It's you just, get married in one state.
Just kind of an honor code system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then eventually maybe you get found out, which apparently he did. But yeah, it's like you get married in Oregon, you get married in Utah. Like, how are they going to know? In the fall of 1976, Roy started a relationship with a woman named Luella Thomas. She later testified that during the course of their relationship, Roy developed a drinking problem and became violent. Now, this is a pattern that repeats throughout Roy's life and relationships, and we will talk about that in greater detail later. But basically, yeah, he had a bad drinking problem, and he became angry and violent when he drank.
Yeah, so maybe it's not a, it developed.
Right.
So from much her, so as, yeah. as it's a continuation of his normal behavior.
Exactly. But from her perspective, it developed, you know. Luella lived in Utah, so that's where Roy was, like, in general in the beginning of 1977. Okay, so it's 1977, and Beverly and Roy have been divorced for nearly 6 years. She's married to Claude, and they have a happy family in San Bernardino. Though her brief marriage to Roy was volatile, like, nothing that I have read indicates that there are any such issues in her marriage to Claude. They seem to just have a nice life. But that all came crashing down on March 30th, 1977. Claude, as I mentioned, was in the Air Force. He was actually a sergeant, and he was working at Norton Air Force Base. When he came home from work on that Wednesday evening, he basically entered a nightmare. His wife, Beverly, was tied to a chair in the living room, slumped over with a single stab wound above her right breast. She was dead. His 8-month-old daughter, Stacy, was sitting in the hallway unharmed, but his two older daughters, Brandy and Tiffany, were missing. Claude, of course, immediately called police. And, you know, because there's a murder and a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old missing, this was not one of those situations where they're like, oh, let's just give it a day.
Well, one would hope.
Right.
I mean, this was, what you said, the 70s? 80s?
77.
77, yeah. That's interesting. So she was tied up and only had one stab wound.
One stab wound.
So that's, to me, not indicative of a crime of passion.
Yeah.
So that doesn't seem as though, at least at the surface level, that it would be somebody that she knew.
Yeah, it's interesting.
One stab wound, quick, painless. Like if it was a crime of passion, so I'm trying to exclude Roy at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Alcoholism, angry temperament. If he were to do something like this, I would assume that it would probably be a lot more violent towards her.
I think that would make sense.
Yeah,
but you know the problem with Roy right off the bat is they'd been divorced for 6 years at this point, right? Well, and so people were immediately asking, like, "What's the point? Why would he do that?" You know,
right? But to further exclude him, that doesn't seem like behavior of somebody that would know her and have pent up aggression towards her,
right? So police came and, you know, clearly treated this as an emergency situation right off the bat. Making it even more dangerous is that Brandy actually had cystic fibrosis. According to the Mayo Clinic, cystic fibrosis is an inherited disorder that causes severe damage to organs, especially the lungs. It also affects the digestive system. And at the time, that was a big issue for Brandy. She actually had to take medicine at every single meal in order to be able to digest her food properly. According to Claude, Brandy, even though she was only five, like, she understood her disease and she was good about taking the pills on her own. She like knew what she had to do. And Beverly was Brandy's advocate. She was actually a member of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. So, of course, Claude and everybody was concerned about this and concerned about Brandy, you know, taking her medication. But apparently the medication that she had to take was like fairly easy to come by. And so they were hoping that whoever had her would be able to get her medication. Now, obviously, I'm sure police looked at Claude as a suspect at first because, you know,
yeah,
he's the husband. Like, you have to. He's the one who found the body. Like,
right. You have to.
Yeah. But, you know, again, he was working at the Air Force Base that day. I'm sure he was around plenty of people.
Yeah, there's plenty of people to alibi him.
Right. They did later give him two polygraphs during the course of the investigation. He passed both. So it just really seems like he was never really a suspect other than, you know, in the way that any husband has to be a suspect.
Sure.
But there are no indications that, like I said, they had any problems in their marriage. He had any motive, anything. But just as quickly as they ruled Claude out, they did rule Beverly's ex-husband, Roy Summers, in. As police questioned neighbors, several reported seeing a man matching Roy's description, putting the girls into a gold Camaro on the afternoon of March 30th. According to newspaper accounts, police issued an APB for Roy the next day on March 31st. The police's theory was that Roy murdered Beverly and then took the two older kids because they would have been old enough to identify him. So that indicates to me, because they were thinking that Roy must have had some sort of relationship with Brandy, because otherwise, like, how would she have been able to identify some random adult?
Yeah, I just don't see that type of killing being a crime of passion. Like, what? You tie somebody up and you stab them once. That's not typical behavior out of a crime of anger and a crime of passion. It's usually much more violent than that. Not saying that would completely rule him out, but I guess I just have a hard time understanding how just him being the ex, that type of crime just doesn't seem to fit this scene.
Well, that might lead into kind of what happens next, though, because maybe police were kind of the same mind. So they caught up with Roy pretty quickly. He was back in Utah. In fact, he had said that he had been in Utah on March 30th when the murder and the kidnappings took place. Police interviewed his girlfriend, Luella, who might have actually been his wife at that point. Not entirely sure. They did get married somewhere in this.
Sure.
And she told police that he had arrived on March 29th, the day before Beverly's murder. Now, they also spoke with other men who lived in Utah who said the same thing, who knew Roy and said that they had actually worked with him on the 30th and that he was there. So, you know, based on that, based on these witnesses saying he was in a completely different state, mm-hmm. and maybe based on kind of what you're saying, that like they couldn't really find a motive, like it didn't really fit, you know, because again, they've been divorced for so long, yeah, like
6 years.
Yeah. You know, they found him. He didn't like have the kids with him.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like they didn't really see much there at the time. And so that was kind of good enough for them. So they basically cleared him just a few days after the murders.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily have cleared him completely, but he would definitely drop from a top-tier suspect for me.
Yeah, and so with them clearing, basically, though, Roy and Claude so quickly, they didn't really have anything else to go on.
Sure. Yeah, what are they left with?
Yeah, and so even though this was a brutal crime and two little girls were missing, like, the case went cold very quickly, it seems like. When I was going through all the archival newspaper footage, like I gave my newspapers.com account like a workout this week, there was basically nothing from like 1977 to 1979. Like that was it. Like there were some articles for about the first month and then like just crickets until the end of 1979. Now, the reason why the newspaper articles started up again in 79 was that during a routine case review, two new detectives, Detective John McDonald and Detective Don Meyer, thought like, oh, hey, maybe we should look back into this because, you know, they kind of took a look at the files and thought, you know, they kind of cleared Roy like pretty quickly. Like, let's see if his alibi was really as good as the first detectives thought it was. They also reexamined evidence that had been found at the scene. One such piece was a map with a route marked from California to Utah. It apparently led to the same town where Roy's now ex-wife, Luella Tullis, lived at the time. According to detectives, when they interviewed her, she said that it was her map and that Roy had had access to it.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, a map with a route from California to Utah found at the crime scene that did not belong to Claude or Beverly or, you know, anybody else who lived in that house was definitely interesting. However, it's not nearly as interesting as the other information that the detectives uncovered. Tiffany and Brandy had been seen in multiple states by multiple people over the past 2.5 years. In fact, the more people and ex-wives they interviewed, the more sightings there were of the girls.
Just sightings of the girls, like not with Roy.
Oh no, some were with Roy. All right, now San Bernardino is in Southern California. In the summer of 1977, shortly after the crimes took place, Roy Summers' sister, Karen Carino, was living in Pleasanton, which is in Central California. When questioned by police, several of Karen's neighbors said that they had seen two children matching Tiffany and Brandy's descriptions at Karen's home on multiple occasions over the summer of 77. They had also seen Roy at the home at that time. Then, from around September through November of 1977, several other witnesses, including a waitress at a diner, said that they had seen Roy and the girls in Elko, Nevada. The waitress said that they were regulars and that Roy told her he had custody because their mother was, quote, no good, end quote. Roy Summers was then seen in Payette, Idaho, in January and February of 1978, and again in the first half of 1979. Other witnesses reported seeing Brandy and Tiffany in Garden City, Idaho, in the summer and fall of 1979. A couple named Juanita and Mike Iwakiri lived in Garden City, and Juanita ran a babysitting service out of her home. Neighbors said that they had seen the girls in her home, and that Juanita had allegedly cared for them kind of on and off from 77 to 79. In the summer of 1979, Tiffany was seen in Manteca, California, at the home of Shirlene Beer, who is another of Roy's sisters. Manteca is very close to Pleasanton, where Karen lived. Now, by 1979, Roy had moved to Redmond, Oregon, and married his seventh wife. The last reported sighting of the girls was in 1980 in Grass Valley, California, where they were seen with a man named Lee Kasner.
Okay, so before we get into who Lee is, you've got me convinced. Clearly, there's enough evidence that Roy has the girls. I'm still hung up on the motive,
right,
for the killing and the kidnapping.
Yeah, because in all of the many, many, many articles that I've read on this case, none of them said that there had been any issues with Roy and Beverly after their divorce.
Right.
Like, at all.
Right. And why go through the trouble of you know, killing her and then kidnapping your daughter and then your daughter's sister, but not the other child?
Well, again, and that's why police say that they left, that he left Stacy because Stacy was 8 months old and, you know, wasn't a witness, basically. And that Brandy and Tiffany were incredibly close as well. So that might have been another reason why he took Tiffany, because Brandy, like, wouldn't have gone with him unless Tiffany was with her.
I guess. I mean, this is all speculation, of course.
Oh yeah, it is. I mean, it's all theory, but like this was the working theory kind of at the time, because yeah, there wasn't really a solid motive. There was another theory that Roy had actually planned on killing everyone, basically, and it was just out of just general rage that he felt toward Beverly, and he wanted to ruin her life and everything good in her life. And maybe he had resentment against Claude as well for, you know, raising his child or whatever. And, you know, the theory is that he went and he killed Beverly, but then didn't have the heart to hurt the girls.
This is all stuff that's been kind of thrown around.
Because, you know, it's been over 40 years, right? Like, a lot of theories develop when a case goes unsolved for 40 years. All right. So I've already thrown like a lot of names out there.
Yeah.
So let's take a moment and talk about, like, who the hell all these people are. Police reopened this case basically in the fall of 1979. Roy was living in Oregon with his seventh wife at the time. They received permission from his wife to search their home. During this search, they found several items, one of which was a notebook. The notebook had the name Lee Kasner in it. When Brandy and Tiffany were allegedly in Idaho, Brandy had actually been identified by a Sunday school teacher who said that she had attended the school. She said that Brandy introduced herself as Brandy Summers and then corrected herself and said that her name was Brandy Kasner.
Okay.
So police already knew this. They knew about this Idaho sighting, the Sunday school thing, and Brandy Kasner. So when they found this notebook and they saw the name Lee Kasner, it stuck out to them.
Right.
So they did some research and found that there was a Lee and Molly Kasner who had moved to Grass Valley, California. In investigating this lead, they learned that the girls had been seen with the couple in Grass Valley, California. But by the time they made it to Grass Valley, there was no sign of either Brandy or Tiffany. Lee Kasner has a sister. Her name is Vivian Kasner. Vivian dated Roy in the late 70s.
Okay, I was waiting for the connection here, but
yeah.
Okay.
Vivian's sister is Juanita Iwakiri, the babysitter in Idaho who allegedly took care of the girls on and off for years. The other main players are Roy's sisters, who are both seen with the girls, Karen Carino and Shirlene Beer. Because this case now spanned several states, California, Utah, Idaho, Nevada, and even Virginia, Karen Carino had actually moved to Springfield, Virginia prior to this case being reopened, San Bernardino police were faced with a logistical nightmare.
Was it that they had too many strings of yarn on their map.
Yes, exactly.
Connecting things, because I'm so confused right now, and like trying to place everybody and everything over the years in my mind, like
it is tough.
Just it's mind blowing right now.
It is. And like for me, I'm a visual learner, so like listening to this in a podcast would be difficult for me. But one of the articles that I found, and we linked obviously to all this on our blog, but I'll also post, they did two very helpful diagrams. One is a map that
legitimately
shows,
has like string from
it doesn't, but it has pins in it.
Yeah, right.
That shows all of the sightings of the girls and with whom they were seen. And then they have like a flow chart of all of the names of and how they're connected. So I'm going to post both of those images in our photo gallery on the blog. So you can go look at that and like, you know, maybe pause now, go take a look. And then they were gone.com on our blog, and like, take a look, because it really like that really helped me kind of get it all straight in my head when I was writing this.
I'm completely confused.
But. Yeah. And what was crazy too, is like in all the articles, names were spelled differently, and like, it just got, and you know, because people were married so many times, their names like changed over the years, and that was very confusing. So yeah, there's a lot going on.
How many times did Roy change his name?
Roy never changed his name, but basically everyone else did. So yeah, like logistical nightmare. This is 1979. There's no internet. Nothing in law enforcement was centralized. So it's like, you know, people are making long distance phone calls, giving tips across jurisdictions.
Yeah, no, I'm telling you, this is like one detective that has a map of the United States with a whole bunch of pins and strings attached to it and maybe some pictures. It's like what you would see in like a bad Netflix FBI show, you know?
Or an excellent one, which is why I'm saying this needs to get turned into a show. So yeah, it was basically just a lot of boots on the ground. They would travel to do interviews. They like flew witnesses and suspects in. It was a lot. After several months of this and feeling like the girls were just slipping through their fingers, because they always just seemed to be two steps behind them, police made a bold move. They just started arresting people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just like, fuck it. We'll lock them up and see if anything sticks, if they confess to something.
Yeah, that was literally their entire plan.
God, to be a cop in the 70s and 80s. Right? And like, you could not get away with that now.
Yeah, no, they just went for it. So they arrested Juanita and Mike Iwakiri, Lee Kasner, and Karen Carino.
On what?
Well, they stacked on everything.
With the obstruction, everything. Maybe?
No, they stacked the charges as high as they could in order to get high bails and pressure them to talk. And what's amazing, and this is how it's different now as opposed to them, because like, this is still something that, you know, prosecutors will do. They'll stack charges.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But because it was 1979, they were like giving interviews to the newspapers, saying it out loud, just being like, oh yeah, no, we're just trying to get him to talk. So we're just like stacking as many charges as we possibly can as a pressure tactic.
Right.
Like they were quoted just saying this in the newspaper.
Yeah, we don't say that anymore.
Yeah.
It still happens.
Yeah. But yeah, they were saying the quiet part out loud and in print.
Not the best tactic.
Right. Then in addition to that, in an effort to lock everybody into their stories, San Bernardino prosecutors convened a grand jury.
For who on what?
For everyone on everything. Among those who were compelled to testify were Roy's sister, Charlene Beer, Charlene's daughter, Nikki Caritas, Vivian Kasner and her husband, Robert James Kasner, Juanita Iwakiri, Mike Iwakiri, Juanita Iwakiri's niece, Faye Downing, Roy and Sandy Frazier, whom I believe knew the Iwakiris and said that they had seen the girls over at their house, and Robert Aldridge, who was Juanita Iwakiri's attorney.
And are they doing this all based on a conspiracy charge?
Well, no, not exactly. Like, they did think that it was basically a criminal conspiracy, but there weren't any formal conspiracy charges
Dick, because conspiracy is extremely difficult to prove.
Yeah, so that was one of the charges that wasn't there. But I'll get to all of the charges that they did put. Now, you know, there's probably one other name, though, out of everyone that's missing that you might have noticed.
Roy?
Yeah. Now, Roy was eventually arrested and charged with the murder of his ex-wife and with kidnapping Tiffany and Brandy. But police weren't super worried about, like, hanging on to him and pulling him in and, you know, getting him to testify at the grand jury because he was already in jail in Oregon.
Okay.
So they knew where he was.
For bigamy?
Oh, no. Something much worse. Oh, and before I get into what Roy was in jail for this time, he had an extensive rap sheet at this point. He had been jailed for rape when he was 19. He had been jailed for multiple assaults, you know, all sorts of things, but he had never had anything that really stuck. Like, he had never done any serious time because, I mean, shit, when he was 19, what would that have been? That would have been probably in the 60s still. Like, rape was barely even considered illegal.
Right.
So, like, yeah, he did not spend time in jail, like any time in prison or anything like that. So most of his charges, he was given like probation or a fine or something like that. But he had a lot. At this point in 1979, Roy, like I mentioned, was on his seventh marriage. He was arrested for trying to murder his wife, Connie. Now, there are several charges, in fact, including a kidnapping and assault charge, because he was also accused of kidnapping his own mother during this. Like, this was all like a thing that happened together. Now, those charges were dropped, as was the attempted murder charge. Roy eventually only stood trial for a misdemeanor assault charge. But you have to listen to the circumstances of this misdemeanor assault. Roy and Connie had what the papers called a struggle in their home, during which he twisted her arm, breaking it in 8 places.
Jesus.
He then choked her until she lost consciousness. When Connie awoke, she was in their garage underneath a car that had been jacked up. According to Connie, Roy then attempted to kick the jacks so that the car would fall on top of her. He was unsuccessful, and they struggled some more before Connie says he abruptly let her go. Her arm was broken so severely that doctors said it needed to be amputated.
Jesus. Also, really elaborate way to murder somebody.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah. And it got down to a simple assault. Despite this horrific crime, I mean, her arm had to be amputated. Like, that's insane. He was only found guilty of this misdemeanor assault and was sentenced to 1 year in the Deschutes County Jail.
And what happened to the kidnapping of his mother charge?
Oh, yeah, that got dropped because his mom said that she would just lie to protect him.
But at some point, there was some sort of kidnapping during this altercation.
It was something like he either, like, I think he had taken Connie and his mother to, like, a hotel and, like, was holding them both against their will. It was something. I don't know. It all got dropped because his mom was like, oh, he didn't mean it. And, yeah. Like, I'm not going to cooperate with your prosecution. During his sentencing hearing, Roy told reporters that he was eager to get to California to prove his innocence in the murder kidnapping. His Oregon sentencing took place on Wednesday, March 19th, 1980, nearly 3 years to the day of Beverly's murder and Tiffany and Brandy's kidnapping. Now, San Bernardino detectives wanted to extradite him immediately, but of course, nothing actually happens quickly in these situations. And he didn't end up back in California until June of 1980 when he was arraigned for the kidnapping and murder.
Still with only circumstantial evidence connecting him.
Yeah. So at this point, we have, again, no clear motive.
Right.
We have no
physical evidence.
Yeah, no
of him
real
being
physical
there.
Evidence, right? Because They're, you know, obviously this is before DNA.
I'm not doubting that he did it.
No, I know. But no, I think that at this point, we do need to kind of go over like what they have, right? So there's no real physical evidence, no DNA, because that's not a thing. It's, you know, 1977 when the murder took place.
77, there wasn't even a solid fingerprint database at that point.
Right. And I don't know if they dusted for prints. I don't know what even
again because there wasn't a solid fingerprint database at that point, so it wasn't common practice.
So there's nothing about that. So the only evidence that was in the house that was connected to Roy was that map, and that even is a tenuous connection. Right.
I was gonna say that in and of itself is circumstantial at best.
Exactly.
There's more evidence with eyewitness testimony that he either kidnapped or has knowledge of where the daughters are.
Right.
But that doesn't directly connect him to murdering his ex-wife.
You're right. It absolutely doesn't. And
again, I'm bigger picture. Clearly it looks like he did it, but without direct evidence pointing to it, what do you have him on?
Going back to kind of theories, there were theories that he could have an accomplice because witnesses, like I said, witnesses say that a man who matched his description was seen putting the girls into a car that afternoon. But witnesses also said that they saw a second man. And, you know, the police were going, well, like, was it a second man or are you just describing the same man in a different way? You know, kind of thing like, you know, did like one neighbor see Roy, the other neighbor saw Roy, but they described him differently or whatever. It was a lot of confusion, which is why...
Using some solid leading question tactics.
Oh, I'm sure. which is why the witnesses were eventually placed under hypnosis.
Always a good tactic.
Yeah. And
light some incense.
And two sketches were released of apparently two separate men. One does look exactly like Roy, but honestly, for all we know, like they could have just been showing them a picture of Roy, like while they were questioning. You know what I mean? I wouldn't put it past them. So
look, the science of investigative techniques back in the '70s or even well into the '80s. Was not really there.
Oh, it's like, still not. I mean, well, so another podcast recommendation real quick is Unraveled. Sure. It's a Billy Jensen podcast. And they, this season, it's season two, they are tackling basically quote unquote experts. Yeah. So like arson investigators, like hair follicle people, like all of that. And just kind of talking about all these times that they've put innocent people in jail because it's all junk science.
The one 17 years in law enforcement, the one thing I have come to really understand is that anything science or law enforcement related, science and law enforcement related, is that it's all based on this is what we used to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's held up in court so far, so we're just going to keep going with that.
Yeah.
And there's very little research. It's only becoming really popular now to actually get some scientific research into things, even the line of questioning, you know, discussing like the Reed technique and how that leads to
false confessions
because of the way you ask questions and the amount.
For those of you who have watched Making a Murderer, very good example of the Reed technique was the Brendan Dassey interview. Yeah.
Oh my God. Like you can, that is picture perfect of how the Reed technique exactly leads to a false confession.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't knock the detectives. I mean, you can.
Yeah, you can.
Because they were dicks. But they were doing what they were trained to do.
Right.
Based on quote unquote scientific police techniques at the time.
Yeah.
Which was not scientific at all. And there has not been a lot of science-based research into police activity until very recently.
Right.
And that's why a lot of the police techniques now are being debunked, because it's like it's not real. It's all based on, hey, we've done this for so long this way, seems to work, let's just keep doing it.
Oh, absolutely. And like these trial experts, like some of them don't have any actual training, or some took like a one-day class.
Yeah, no, it absolutely. I mean, look, with my credentials, people would probably consider me a subject matter expert on defensive tactics and fighting techniques for law enforcement. I've been certified in 5 different forms of defensive tactics for law enforcement. I've taught a combination of all of those 5 different techniques or 5 different schools for 15 years. It sounds
very fancy.
Yes. Really what it is that I went to a school once for each one of these 5 different schools of defensive tactics, and brought that together with my previous knowledge of boxing and martial arts, and kind of created my own thing. And that's kind of what most police departments do. None of that is scientific. It's, here's our base knowledge. Let's see what we can do.
Yeah.
And kind of get away with it. That's kind of the way policing works.
Yeah, and that's modern policing. So yes. Go back to 1977, where there were 1979. No, rules. No, it was a free-for-all. You know, with this case, it's interesting that you're already picking up on the problems. We've got some flaws already. We've got some potential minefields, I think, that we're already coming across right here. And, you know, I think the fact that they just rounded everyone up and kind of arrested them, charged them with all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, based on nothing.
Yeah, they convened this grand jury like after the arrests, you know, basically, like I said, to lock them into a story. They were saying, listen, we're pressuring these people. You know, they were very open about their aggressive tactics toward all of these people in this case. And that absolutely does cause problems as the trials start. So that's what we're going to be talking about next week, right? So next week, we are going to be talking about the main trial, which is Roy's trial, and then all of the other legal proceedings for these, for lack of a better word, co-conspirators.
Yeah.
Right? Because again, at this point, the police believe Roy murdered his ex-wife, possibly with an accomplice. And that he has this network of family and friends who are helping him shuttle the girls across the country and evade police.
The evidence definitely points to the latter part.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there's no clear-cut evidence that he actually committed the murder.
Yeah.
I mean, common sense, yes, says he did it. But.
Right. I mean, he's obviously a violent person.
Sure.
Right. I mean, he has now been convicted of assault, but, you know, trying to kill his wife.
Right.
Yeah. So, like, it's not outside of the realm of possibilities, certainly.
No, but again.
But you're right. There's nothing solid.
Right.
Yes. So, next episode, we're going to get into that. But even though we haven't gotten to that part yet, it still seems completely insane to me that these two girls weren't found in 1979 or 1980 when all of this was happening. Like, I mean, they were right there. I mean, when they started making these arrests, the most recent sighting of the girls was like 7 weeks prior. Like, that's how close they were. But what's really chilling about all of this is that after the arrests started, the sightings of the girls stopped. Cystic fibrosis, which Brandy suffered from, is a progressive disease, and in the late 70s, the prognosis was not good. At the time, it was rare for people with CF to live much past their 18th birthdays. Brandy would be 49 years old today, so the chances of her still being alive are slim. But that's not the case with Tiffany. Tiffany would be 46 years old now, and her family thinks that she could still be out there somewhere. She may have been adopted into an unrelated family or could have remained with someone connected in some way to Roy Summers. Now, just as a reminder, the states involved in this story are California, Nevada, Idaho, Utah, Oregon, and Virginia. Roy Summers is dead. If there are still people out there carrying his secrets, it's been long enough. He is gone, but Claude Wise is still alive. So is Stacy Wise. they deserve to know what happened to Brandy and Tiffany. Brandy Summers and Tiffany Wise have been missing since March 30th, 1977. Brandy was about 4 feet tall and 50 pounds when she went missing. She had blonde hair and blue hazel eyes. She had 2 3-to-4-inch surgical scars and a round nickel-sized surgical scar on her abdomen, as well as a scar on her face. Brandy often went by her middle name, Jondell. She may have been using the last names Beer, Carino, Iwakiri, Iwakin, and or Wise. She was suffering from cystic fibrosis and needed medication at every meal in order to digest her food properly. She was 5 years old when she went missing. She would be 49 today. Tiffany was 3'5" and around 40 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She had reddish blonde hair and blue hazel eyes. She has a surgical scar extending from behind her hairline to the back of her head. Tiffany may be using the last names Iwakin, Beer, or Kasner. She was 2 years old when she disappeared. She would be 46 today. If you have any information on what happened to Brandy and Tiffany, please contact the San Bernardino Police Department at 909-384-5142. You can see all of the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for part 2, or if you're on Patreon, we'll see you tomorrow. And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join my Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.